Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of Cure Talks, joining you from India, and I wish everyone a very happy new year. We begin this year with a review on myeloma research and activities in 2015 with the MMRF. This is Cure Talks' 99th episode. My co-host for today's talk is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. And supporting Gary on the panel are members of our myeloma panel, Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, Cynthia Schmulewski, and Matt Coleman. Welcome to the first talk in 2016, everyone. It is with immense pleasure that I welcome today's featured guest, Anne Trin Young of the MMRF, to Cure Talks once again. Great to have you on Cure Talks, Anne. 2015 saw a lot of action in the myeloma world. Four new drugs were approved by the FDA, increasing treatment options and allowing new combinant regimens. Promising immunotherapy research results will see these being used in the clinical practice. What does all this research progress and drug approvals signify for the myeloma patient community? In the hour-long discussion, we will also be reviewing MMRF's research initiatives in the last year and what patients can expect in the coming new year. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you very much, Priya. And as always, we in the myeloma patient community and those of us who are myeloma advocates certainly appreciate all you do for the myeloma patient community, and also I would like to thank Anne Quinn Young for all the MMRF does for the myeloma patient community. I think that the fact that we've brought four new drugs to market in 1 year, which I'm pretty sure that's probably 20-30% of all cancer drugs for a cancer that represents just 1% of all patients, means that a lot of people are doing a lot of things right in order to bring these great things to market. So I certainly do appreciate that and welcome you, Anne, to the program and thank you and everybody, including Kathy Juicy, for all her fine work. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you to give us a rundown of what's happened at the MMRF in 2015 and what's your plans for the future.
Well, thank you so much, Priya and Gary. Priya, congratulations on the 99th program, and thank you so much for having us back on the show. It's always such a pleasure to be here and an honor to represent the MMRF in front of all these incredible patients. As you've just heard, and I'm sure most of you had already known, 2015 was really a historic year for myeloma. As both Priya and Gary mentioned, we had four new drugs approved, including three during a whirlwind 3 weeks toward the end of the year. And what's really even more exciting about these four drugs is that they represent two brand new classes. The first one that was approved about almost a year ago is the first HDAC inhibitor, which is panobinostat or Faradac. And that is typically used later on in the disease and works very well with Velcade. But it's being looked at in a lot of different combinations and stages of the disease. And then the first two antibodies toward the end of the year, elotuzumab or Emplicity and daratumumab or Darzalex, were the, again, first two antibodies ever approved for this disease. And they have the ability to really transform the treatment of the disease, possibly as early as, you know, first line or even in smoldering patients. Some of the trials are looking at those treatments in early populations. And then the first oral proteasome inhibitor, exazimib or Ninlaro. And for those of you who may be new to this, as a reminder, the proteasome inhibitors are Velcade and Kyprolis, and together with IMiDs and steroids tend to form a common backbone of therapy. And as Gary mentioned, it's somewhat surprising, and for those of us who have been in the field since before Velcade was approved almost 13 years ago, it's exciting, but perhaps not so surprising because of the amazing community we have in this disease, the collaboration between doctors and researchers, companies, patients, groups like ours, groups like this. It's incredible. And, you know, for us as an organization, we're continuing to build on the model that we've had in place since our inception. And what our goal is to accelerate new treatments and cures. And the foundational model for this is our end-to-end system in precision medicine. And when I say precision medicine, you know, we're not just talking about genomics, but we mean it in the broadest sense that we are trying to find the right treatment or the right combination of treatments in the right sequence for any myeloma patient. To lay it out simply, we look at three different components, and you can feel free to visit our website afterwards and learn a little bit more. But to suffice it to say, it starts with our data bank. And in a heterogeneous disease like myeloma, everyone on this line, I'm sure, knows that you have a very different type of myeloma than, you know, the person sitting next to you in the cancer center. And even within patients, there are different clones. So it's a very complicated disease that's also changing. And this, all the time. This means we need a critical mass of high-quality genomic and clinical data. The MMRF was the first to launch a genomics initiative 10 years ago in the disease, long before there was a genomics initiative in any cancer, including the solid tumors. By building a collaboration between the centers and genomics experts like Broden Tjen, myeloma was the first genome to be sequenced because of the collaboration that we put together. But we didn't stop at that 250. We realized we really needed longitudinal data, clinical match with genomics. And that's where the MMRF COMPASS study was born. We now have 1,000 patients, 1,000 myeloma patients enrolled to be followed over 8 years from the point of diagnosis through each relapse, collecting all the clinical data and doing genomic sequencing on whole genome sequencing, whole exome sequencing, RNA sequencing. And I'm happy to say we now have the largest genomic data set of any cancer. There are more than 800 sequences available. And through the learning network, we feel very strongly about pushing that data out into the entire world. When we put COMPASS together, we didn't want anything slowing down the dissemination of data. We wanted to make sure it wasn't just the 90 centers that were working on the COMPASS study that had access to it, but all the brilliant minds across the world, across disciplines as well. So we made sure that there was no IP related to the study, that any inventions went into the public domain. We've also formed partnerships like one with GNS Healthcare to use artificial intelligence, computer programming to map the pathways much faster than could be done in a lab. And then the final step in the model, collecting and aggregating the data and making it available, analyzing it, and then it's driving it to the clinic, because at the end of the day, that's what's most important. And through our clinical research network, the MMRC, we continue to open 6 to 10 trials a year, focusing on novel classes like HDAC inhibitors and some new ones that haven't yet made it to market, targeted treatments, and those are based on molecular alterations. So if you have a specific genomic mutation, there may be a treatment for you, as well as immune. So, you know, when we look back at 2015, certainly, you know, what dominates is the four drugs approved. But for us, we completed enrollment of the COMPASS study. So we hit that 1,000-patient mark in about 4 years. As I said, it took 90 centers, four different countries, and, you know, a lot of folks working together. And what's really neat to me personally is now I'm finding that, you know, all over the place I'm meeting COMPASS patients, and it's really inspiring to me because they understand what they're part of. They understand the value to the field and to the value to them specifically. And that is very different than the world was 5 years ago, when I think genomics was a much more overwhelming topic for patients. Recently at ASH in December, the American Society of Hematology meeting, we presented the first real clinical findings from COMPASS. And COMPASS is starting to answer some really important questions to patients. You know, one being, is it really more beneficial to be on a triplet versus a doublet? Now, you know, the vast majority of academic centers are treating patients up front with a triplet versus a doublet, but does it matter? And indeed, we did find that there is a significant difference in terms of time to progression for patients who were treated with a triplet versus a doublet. We're also starting to see that across a lot of different variables, having a stem cell transplant earlier is advantageous. And you know, we need to delve down to try to figure out, are there certain groups of patients where that may or may not, that may not be the case. But having some of these larger questions at least have some additional light being shed on them is incredibly important and allows patients to have a better idea of how to proceed in their treatment course. And on the clinical trial front, we opened 6 different trials, and what was particularly exciting about these trials were the first 2 for smoldering myeloma. In the past, we had focused on upfront treatments as well as relapse refractory, and last year we opened a trial with daratumumab or Darzalex, as well as one with elotuzumab or Emplicity plus Revdex. We also opened the first targeted trial for a patient population with a specific alteration, and that's an MDM2 inhibitor from Roche in combination with the oral proteasome inhibitor Ninlaro for deletion of 17p patients. And then a third trial that was particularly interesting was the first PD-L1 inhibitor to be studied in myeloma, and that was open across MMRC centers as well. And then finally, we launched late in the year a screening program with the University of Michigan where we're able to sequence relapse patients who are seen at MMRC centers, and there is potential to expand it beyond MMRC centers as well, to sequence them and then to match them to trials like the MDM2 inhibitor in Ninlaro and others that we're planning to open this year that focus on a specific patient population. So switching gears a little bit into 2016, you know, when we look at our main focus, and it's only 3 weeks into the year, but it's pretty clear that one key area of focus has to be to figure out how all of these treatments. Now we have this, you know, almost embarrassment of riches of 10 drugs available, you know, 6 of which are probably going to be seen at multiple times in a patient's treatment course. You know, what is the best way to combine these drugs, to sequence them, to dose them, to combine them with investigational agents, and really start to answer some of those questions from investigator-initiated trials through the MMRC, and also starting to look at COMPASS and other data sets. A second main focus for us is really continuing to, you know, advance the precision medicine model and really push toward the clinic. So we opened at the end of last year our first targeted trial, and we plan to open a couple of more this year and then look at broader protocols where we can screen many different patients at once and put them into the right arm for them. And then finally, and you'll hear more about this later in the year, late last year we also completed a quantitative patient survey on the myeloma patient journey. And so we will be looking at all of our educational program offerings, and perhaps enlisting the help of some of you on the line as well, to make sure that we really are meeting the needs of patients at every point. So, you know, really in closing before we move to the Q&A, you know, the progress really has been absolutely, absolutely stunning. And it gives all of us such hope and inspiration when we see patients living to see milestones and celebrations that they thought perhaps they would never see. On the flip side, you know, we're not there yet. You know, the disease is still largely incurable. And around here, driven by Kathy, our founder, you know, we firmly believe it's not the time to become complacent, that we still see patients relapsing and still see this really complicated, determined disease becoming more difficult to treat as time goes on. So we are inspired by the progress. We're incredibly hopeful. This disease looks very different than it did even 5 years ago, but I can assure everyone on the phone that we are not taking our foot off the accelerator. We are pushing to get more extensive remissions made possible by treatments that have fewer side effects for every single patient. So I'll stop there. Again, thank you so much for this opportunity, and I look forward to the Q&A.
All right. Well, thank you, Anne. That was excellent. We really do appreciate it, and we do appreciate all your efforts. You know, I look at the National Cancer Institute, and they provide about $45 million each year for research for multiple myeloma. And I think you guys are already in the 275 range that you've
Over 300 over time. Yeah.
I'm always behind, it seems like. You guys always are ahead of me on that. But to think that, and not only that, it's a focused and a business model that is used. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've had so much success. Again, I want to thank you. I want to thank Kathy. I want to thank everybody for this. And also the ASH study, which I think, you know, there's so much data out there, but nobody captures it. And this is one of the very first attempts at doing that, and I think it's a gold mine. And I really thank you for your initiative there. But at ASH, I noticed that most immunotherapy, you know, which is not a drug, but it's really your CAR T cells, MILs, and dendritic cells, rose like a phoenix out of the ashes. It just wasn't really talked about in the prior year, and it came from nowhere. It seemed like everybody was an immunotherapist. You know, that was the big talk, and it went from nowhere to top billing. So what is the MRF doing in this very exciting area of treatment? We've heard of all these dramatic results from some of the CAR T cell and MIL and dendritic cell trials that are out there. But you know, I was wondering what MMRF is going to do in that area as well. It seems like the next new horizon.
Yeah. You know, when we and we agree. I mean, there's so much potential in immune therapy, and I think being able to take a lot of these different approaches and combine them is really going to be the key in terms of longer remissions. When we think about immune therapy, we largely look at three different buckets: the antibodies, this field of engineered T cells, and then vaccines. And you know, funny enough, when Kathy started the MMRF back in 1998. And even when I started in 2002, a majority of our research funding was supporting researchers in the area of vaccines. And, you know, a lot of that didn't really come to fruition, but perhaps it was a little bit ahead of its time. And more recently, you know, particularly with the two antibodies that were FDA approved last year, we've been doing a lot of different studies within the MMRC looking at these antibodies, as I mentioned earlier, in different patient populations, smoldering, upfront, relapse refractory, and in different combinations. You know, I mentioned the PD-L1 inhibitor trial, really, really exciting and rolling like gangbusters through the MMRC. And what that does, it's a checkpoint inhibitor. So instead of these other antibodies, which target primarily receptors on the surface of the myeloma cell. They do, you know, have an impact on the immune system as well, but they're really targeting the myeloma cell. What these checkpoint inhibitors do, and you know, have completely transformed diseases like melanoma. They allow a patient's immune system to recognize the tumor cell and really fight it off. So instead of the myeloma cell evading your immune system, the checkpoint inhibitors, you know, can serve to kind of wake it up and help your own immune system, you know, fight it off. So really exciting. And then you mentioned the area of CAR T, and certainly first at ASCO when, you know, the first results from the UPenn study were presented, and the one patient who still to this day, it's 18 months later, a patient who had never had even any kind of dural remission to anything, including her first transplant, to be in a complete remission, absolutely no evidence of myeloma is amazing. You know, but again, we're looking at small patient sizes. The BCMA, the very early BCMA work that was presented at ASH, again, you know, it was a late-breaking session, tons of potential and excitement, just really, really early days and not at all ready for, you know, prime time in these larger trials. So, you know, what what I can say, and perhaps we can, talk again later in the year, we are in the process of building some collaborations, really predominantly in the area of the engineered T cells, but also vaccines, and expanding some of the work in the antibody area, particularly with the checkpoint inhibitors.
Okay, and thank you so much for that. One of the things that I find, the whole model that we have currently, which is, you and your folks are looking at drugs, and doing the initial research and then handing those off, and ultimately it's a drug company that spends, the $2 to $2.5 billion for each new drug that goes to market. At least that's what I've been seeing. And how do we fund things like CAR T cells and MILs, which don't necessarily fit into a drug company's business plan? There's potentially no billions for this development, and as a result, the model has to change in some way, or there just won't be any funding for these things. It's kind of like a stem cell transplant. It's a hospital that, benefits from the cost, or from the money that a patient pays for a stem cell transplant. It's not a drug company. So, how do you get the billions to support CAR T cells, MILs, and dendritic cell research? And that's one of the reasons maybe it hasn't come to fruition very quickly, because there's just no funding for it.
Yeah, well, there is, I think, based on some of the leukemia results from the trials at UPenn, certainly there are some companies, including Novartis, who is involved in this area, and then some others that, financially look like they're doing pretty well, like Kite or Juno, forming collaborations with bigger companies as well. So I do think that there does seem to be, again, based on the interest of some of these companies into coming into the area, that there will be interest. I think the key will really prove to be, figuring out the right patient population, because it will be very, very expensive to, the manufacturing. So I think for companies to feel very comfortable, back to precision medicine, who are the patients that are most likely to respond, and figuring out the right target, because these engineered T cells, you can target different receptors, and CD19, which has been which is highly expressed in leukemia, is not expressed in myeloma. So is that the right target, or is a BCMA? So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of I think refining this for multiple myeloma. And then the other piece on the funding side, if that does become a challenge, we as an organization have supported for many years now, supported biotech companies with what we call the Biotech Investment Awards. And it's really to get them over the critical hump of, some of the preclinical work, even scale up in manufacturing, and then into early clinical trials. So that's a program that, we don't have any new investments planned right now, but it's something where we're always, looking at, okay, what are some, really exciting new areas for treatment? And, if there is a funding issue, can we, potentially partner with some, investors, if you will, and put some venture money toward this to make sure that these approaches do have the funding they need?
I think there's some billionaire who sees the need for this, and he's put some consortium together. I read recently for cancer immunotherapy, and maybe it's a whole new funding source, something like that, or maybe even to the work that Vice President Biden will be doing with his new initiative of the moonshot. But with that, I want to turn it over to Jack Aiello. Jack, you online?
Hi, Ann. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jack.
Happy New Year.
I think the MRF was founded either in 97 or 98, if memory serves me right. We've known each other pretty much that whole time. So I wish all of you at the MRF and you as well a Happy New Year. I think as patients, we think of the International Myeloma Foundation, the IMF, as a very patient-centric organization, whereas the MRF is very research-centric and both really benefit the patient. But just as I know the IMF has some significant research programs, I know the MMRF also offers some opportunities for patient education. And you talked about, you mentioned the patient journey. Maybe you can describe those areas of patient education that the MMRF has?
Sure. No, thank you. And Jack, it's such a, even if it's, you know, with many, many other people listening, it really is such a pleasure to hear your voice. And yeah, I think I've known you for the entire time I've been here, and we appreciate all the many years of support. So, you know, we do. We have a lot of programs, and, you know, I can kind of give you broad strokes of again, how the patient journey may impact us. But you know, we do have a comprehensive website, you know, mymmrf.org. You can go there directly and find out, you know, everything you need to know in terms of, you know, from diagnosis to treatment. You know, we do have print brochures. We're always very conscious of helping patients understand all of the different options because this is a disease where we all know, at least in the later stages, combinations are important and really don't kind of single out one treatment or class versus another. We also, as you know, particularly focused on the research side and on what's coming down the pike for treatments, we do webcasts following major medical meetings, and those tend to get thousands of folks listening. It's us together with, you know, some of the some of our partners who just presented the data at the meetings, and then you know we have half day patient symposia, and then the two other major areas of focus are a patient support center, and that's a little bit different than some of the others in that, you know, you can call up and the myeloma trained nurses will answer any questions, but it's really focused on clinical trials matching and really making it as easy as possible for someone who may be a candidate for a clinical trial but has absolutely no idea, you know, how to search for clinical trials or how to get in touch with a center and making that as seamless and as easy as possible. And then the final piece being our community gateway, which really was designed as part of our overall precision medicine initiative. The idea really was once we start these trials in specific patient populations, whether it's deletion 17P or translocation 414, whatever it may be, that we start to build a critical mass of patients who then, you know, we could let them know about these trials and you know, hopefully facilitate enrollment. You know, we have more than 3,000 patients on there. Many of them are highly engaged, but we will be, together with, you know, the work that we're doing in terms of implementing the results from the patient journey, probably doing some pretty significant changes to the community gateway to make sure that it's really meeting the needs of the patients but also advancing precision medicine.
And then my second question requires you to get your crystal ball out, and it's referring to minimum residual disease, MRD, and where it stands. I've been hearing about MRD now for 3-4 years, and yet if a patient who thinks it's a procedure to get a more accurate reading of their myeloma, which it is, asks for MRD tests, they really have a difficult time getting it. They don't know whether MRD is defined as next generation flow or next generation sequencing. Should it be done with or without diagnostic scans? So I know you have that great crystal ball, and you need to tell us when the patient will typically be able to ask and receive an MRD test.
That's a tough. I'll talk a little bit around it, I want to make sure, you know, all on the phone really understands minimal residual disease. The name is fairly self-explanatory, but it really is the deepest possible look to make sure that there's absolutely no myeloma lurking anywhere. And why this is really important, it's important for a couple of reasons, but from a practical sense, you know, now that we have all of these amazing treatments and patients are, particularly in the frontline setting, they aren't relapsing for a long time. We need to make sure we're coming up with some new markers to be able to predict, which patients, may or may not need to be on maintenance therapy, for example. If you have, if you have no MRD, do you need to be on maintenance until progression, particularly if you don't have any other high-risk features? And then in terms of companies being attracted to the field, it's important, to be able to, not have these trials go on forever and ever if patients and become very expensive and take a lot of resources. Are there ways to have surrogate endpoints like MRD where you're potentially seeing signs of when a patient could relapse faster? So, we really are agnostic in terms of, which technology, whether it's next-generation sequencing or flow, is superior. As part of the COMPASS study, we're working with Antonio Palumbo in Italy and a number of Italian sites to incorporate a comparison of flow versus next-gen sequencing. And again, all that data comes back into the COMPASS study. And there are a number of other studies, larger studies, incorporating measurement of MRD. Within our clinical research network, we're looking at studies, again, that incorporate MRD as an endpoint, particularly those that are looking at patients earlier in the disease course. And then finally, when I mentioned, looking at some of these master protocol concepts where instead of having, eight different, protocols, we would have, one master protocol where patients would be screened, and then depending on whether or not they had a specific alteration, they would be put into an arm of the trial or, put into standard of care plus an experimental treatment. That trial would absolutely have MRD endpoints. We've met with FDA on this. We've, participated in meetings with Sloan Kettering that's doing a lot of work in the field. So, I would defer to our scientists, but the field is moving, and there really is a lot of momentum behind this and really validating it as an endpoint. And then once it's clear, is there the best way to measure this? Working with, there's one predominant company in next-gen sequencing. That's something that we would be, if that proved to be the best way to measure MRD, we would be fully behind. How do you bring this to mainstream practice? How do you get reimbursement done? Obviously, there's a whole host of issues. But it is a focus of ours and incorporating it into trials.
Thanks, Ann. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Jack. Cynthia Chmielewski, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Are you feeling okay?
I'm feeling fine.
Yeah, I asked that because this is the very first time you've only had one question.
Well, I'll still have a few other questions as we're talking about, but I'll stick to my one today. Hi, Ann.
Okay.
How you doing?
Hi, Cindy.
My question is talking about the data that you've been, I guess, speaking of throughout our conversation tonight. This topic of big data always interested me. I remember having a couple conversations with you a few years ago about how the MMRF is using this big data. And I know the MMRF has this data bank that you have been talking about. Can you just explain what big data is and how this big data could be helping us to accelerate a cure and how this all relates to the MMGI, the COMPASS study, the gateway, and the patient registry that I see that you're beginning to develop? That's why there's only one question. It's a big question.
It's a big question.
I know. It is big. And I covered a little bit of this earlier, but it does, bear repeating because it's complicated. I mean, I was having a conversation with someone recently who was recently diagnosed, a patient, and you know, he basically said, you know, it's a fascinating disease if someone else had it, you know. It is really fascinating in terms of, you know, again, it not only differs between patients, but within a single patient, you have multiple clones. So the first one you mentioned, the Genomics Initiative, again, that was an initial partnership where MMRC centers at the time collected patients' tissue. So when you were having a, you know, getting a bone marrow pull, you got an extra pull for the tissue bank, and then that led to the first sequencing of the myeloma genome. We ended up with 250 samples, and you know, one finding that is very relevant today, and you know, we feel gratified by you know, this undertaking was a mutation in a gene called BRAF, and it's common in melanoma, but had never been seen before in myeloma. It's now present in about 5 to 8% of myeloma patients, and you know, if you are sequenced and have that mutation, you can be put on either, you know, a BRAF inhibitor or now more commonly a BRAF MEK inhibitor, and potentially go into a complete response. And that's one of the trials that we'll be opening through the MMRC later this year. And that was only possible because we had a deeper look at the disease. Until then, you know, it was conventional cytogenetics in FISH, which is still done, you know, predominantly even at community centers, or gene expression profiling. So bringing the sequencing technology to myeloma, again, you know, brought forward something that had never been seen before. And so we've built on that with Compass. And, you know, the interesting thing about Compass is it's now 1,000 patients, and it's longitudinal. So that means there'll be literally thousands of samples that are analyzed. But the truth is, with the heterogeneity of the disease, you know, we're looking at combining that with other data sets to get, you know, the most robust look at this disease as possible. And so, you know, idea behind the Compass and then building out the researcher gateway where all the data is publicly available was that other centers would share their data as well. As we continue to build out Compass and follow patients longitudinally. So, you know, that's really our goal and our hope, and we're still looking for that first setter to say, look, we'll give you, you know, we'll contribute the data. And then, you know, the next step that you mentioned is building out a registry. And, you know, that is the next logical step in terms of, you know, expanding beyond this 1,000 patients. How do we start to collect data on thousands of patients? So it's something that, you know, the Compass, you know, we wanted to do it right, and that took some planning, and we want to make sure that when we do launch a registry, that, again, it really is meeting all of the needs of the field and really helping to advance new treatments and cures for patients.
Thank you so much. Would the registry include, when you build it, patients that are relapsed refractory? I know the Compass study was just for the newly diagnosed.
Yeah, you know, again, it's a little, because there's no protocol yet for a registry. You know, I can say, though, that we would be looking to be as inclusive as possible, and figuring out ways to make sure that it's available to, you know, the patients can enroll and contribute their data, whether they, you know, may be relapse refractory, whether they're, you know, at a center that's not part of the clinical research network, which either tend to be large academic centers or, you know, centers that are, you know, predominantly community centers, but in urban areas. So it's quite a daunting task. But we're, you know, we're really looking at the landscape and seeing that there's a lot. You know, I think what we really see is that there are a lot of these silos, and these disparate efforts, and we want to bring it all together. And certainly not duplicate any efforts, and maybe there's ways to build upon existing efforts without, you know, starting from scratch.
That sounds like a good plan. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Matt Goldman, are you online?
Yes, I am. Hey, Gary. Hey, everybody.
Hey,
Matt. I just have one question, Anne. Maybe this is just my perception, but it feels like that the age of myeloma patients seems to be trending younger. I don't know. It just sort of seems like that. But I'm wondering if in the MMRS initiatives and data gathering, if you're doing any research into patient demographics and profiles to see if there's any common theme or maybe look at actual causes of myeloma, if there's environmental factors that maybe would jump out from all this data. Is any of that happening?
Well, there's a few different questions rolled into your one question.
Yeah.
So the first one, in terms of the age of diagnosis, you know, to my knowledge, the median age is still, you know, somewhere around age 70. But I think, as we all know, it can sometimes take, you know, a while for data sources to catch up, because I've certainly seen, it seems like there are younger patients. We are, through Compass, one thing I didn't mention that we're quite proud of is it's really a snapshot of the disease, at least in the U.S. In that, you know, we have, I think, patients from age 19 to 91 enrolled, and they're at about the proportions that you would see naturally occur, you know, that are naturally occurring across all diagnoses. We also have, proportionate representation from different ethnic groups. So, you know, you hear African Americans being underrepresented in clinical trials. Well, you know, we, through Compass, you know, there's proportional representation. So we really are, looking at this as a snapshot of what the disease looks like across many, many different variables. And so I think that'll start to, you know, perhaps shed some light, too, on whether, you know, myeloma that's diagnosed younger versus older, is that a different kind of disease? I do think that what I've seen, at least in my 13 years, is that diagnoses are happening earlier. Without a doubt, there are far more smoldering patients and patients who are being diagnosed following routine blood work for physicals or insurance versus, you know, these very, very sick stage 3 patients that seem to be very common, many years ago. And it's important because hopefully there's that window to better control the disease earlier. And perhaps, if one of these antibodies works to prevent the disease in smoldering, you know, maybe a smoldering patient never develops full-blown myeloma. In terms of causes, we are still, because of the nature of the disease and the fact that, again, the vast majority of patients still relapse, we're very much focused on treatments right now, although, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we are, you know, we had never looked at smoldering before because, you know, the knee really was predominantly relapsed refractory, and making sure that when patients, you know, ran out of options, that there were other things in the pipeline for them. Now that we have this, robust portfolio of approved drugs and still ones coming down the pike, or drugs approved for other in other diseases, we are looking earlier in terms of, you know, newly diagnosed and smoldering. And then there are some studies now looking at, are there hereditary predictors? I don't know how many of you saw the Wall Street Journal article toward the end of last year featuring Kathy and her family, which, you know, there's significant, not just myeloma, but significant cancer, and opted to have not only sequencing of her tumor, but sequencing of her regular genome to see, you know, could there be any hints about, you know, myeloma genes? And it'll take, because it's uncommon and because sequencing is not readily available to everyone, you know, this is probably, you know, some years down the pike, but perhaps we will get to a point where there may be a myeloma gene or predisposition identified.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess just thank you. Just to add on to that, again, this is sort of in my mind, it'd be interesting to know outside of genetics what environmental factors, what things are people
yeah.
exposed to. Can we differentiate between things that environments that people live in and what may have play some sort of role in even becoming smoldering? I mean,
right.
Do you think that's more of like an academic exercise versus something
epidemiology? And I do, you know, there obviously have been things like Agent Orange that have been associated with not just myeloma but other blood cancers, or you know, very extreme exposures. The World Trade, you know, being first responders to the World Trade Center. But and then, you know, certainly in other diseases there are these cancer clusters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know there have been some research. I know Mayo, and I think at least Mayo has looked at, you know, again, you're back to hereditary, but at least in families, which could be hereditary or could be that common environmental exposure. So it's not passed through the genes, but everyone lived in the same town and was exposed to something. You know, I think there's some anecdotal discussions, but people have come to me and the foundation, and we've passed them on to some researchers, but again, the numbers are so small that I don't think anything yet has really, aside from a really extreme exposure like the atomic bomb or Agent Orange,
sure.
there haven't really been definitive exposures defined.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. And what we'd like to do now is go to Pat Killingsworth. Pat said he wanted to bat clean up, so... Pat?
Thanks, Gary. Hi, Ann. I didn't see you at ASH this year. Sorry I missed you.
I know. I was there very, very briefly, but it really is, Pat, it's awesome to hear your voice, because I know you've had some challenges lately, so it's great to hear you.
Yeah, I was the guy hiding behind that mask and hat. So... But could you run through? It went so fast. So when you started talking about a couple of the new inhibitors and several of the new drug classes, could you just back up and I mean, which of these drug classes do you see? Are any of them going to be as important as proteasome inhibitors or IMIDs? I mean, do you see one of these other classes as emerging and having that amount of impact?
You know, you're asking like Jack with the crystal ball, and certainly not from a scientist or a clinician either. You know, what I would say is, and don't forget steroids too, because as much as I think a lot of people would like to see steroids go away, they're still seem to be part of that backbone. You know, it's really hard to say. You know, there haven't been many agents that have single agent activity. Even IMIDs don't really have much single agent activity, you know, at least when there's active disease, not in the maintenance setting. So I think some of these antibodies, the daratumumab has had single agent activity in heavily refractory patients and, you know, has the benefit of not, and some of these other antibodies as well, not having overlapping toxicity. So they don't, you know, they're not causing, lower blood counts and GI issues and some of the other things that you see with proteasome inhibitors or conventional chemo. So I think those, you know, perhaps there could be classes of antibodies. It could be the anti-CD38 ones that could become part of a backbone. I think it comes back to what I said earlier and really a focus of the foundation is understanding the right combinations and the right sequences for patients. Right now all patients are treated more or less up front with these broadly acting treatments. There's nothing particularly targeted. And maybe that'll be the mainstay, or maybe it won't be. But it,
sure,
you know,
figuring
habits,
out which
again,
drug to give to which patient and when. I get it,
yeah.
And sure, the daratumumabs of the world. But I was thinking more of these checkpoint inhibitors and all of that. I mean, people start getting excited about some of these things. I just wondered if some of them might stick.
Yeah, you know, I think it's early days. Again, I mentioned that, you know, within the MMRC, that PD-L1 antibody trial has enrolled. It's both in an early relapse, but also in patients who are very, very early relapse off of a stem cell transplant. You know, it's been enrolling really quickly. So clearly there's a lot of excitement. We don't have any data yet, but I think it goes back to, you know, having these treatments that don't have the same kinds of toxicities. You know, some of these other broader classes like the HDAC inhibitors, you know, the selinexor one, that could have broader applicability. They're not, you know, targeting a specific mutation. It's early days. I couldn't even say what the next class of drugs that would be approved could be. But, you know, we're really looking a lot at the, you know, in terms of large classes moving forward, the antibodies, and then, you know, for patients who have specific mutations, you know, do some of these molecularly targeted agents really make a difference?
Sure, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, and it's not.
No,
I mean,
that's what I'm here for.
You're just so close to it. I know it isn't specifically your area of expertise, but how about patient quality of life stuff? I mean, the way you guys are branching out. And by the way, your website. While everybody was talking, I was on the site, and it's so easy to. It looks like to get up to talk to one of these counselors, one of these nurse counselors. It really works slick, nice. Patient quality of, because it's not that the oncologists don't care and the hematologists don't care, but, you know, when we're living 3 and 4 years, that was one thing. But now as we're living 6 and 8 and 10 and 15 years, you know, quality of life takes on a whole new meaning. And I just wondered if they're, you know, if the MMRF is doing anything as far as that goes.
You know, I think it has to increasingly be part of, you know, just what the strategy or the consideration in terms of what treatments are brought forward, not just, you know, are they effective, but, you know, what's the side effect profile. And you know, again, I feel like I keep going back to some of these antibodies, but they really... you know, that they're not the most convenient in terms of, you know, infusion times right now, but in terms of, you know, having some of these side effects that can really affect a patient's day-to-day living, they're not present. And I think figuring out, you know, really it's not only the right combination sequence, but the right dosing for every patient. Because, you know, again, the disease is heterogeneous, and patients, as everyone well knows, tolerates these treatments very differently as well. So, we are mindful of that and really do encourage, you know, patients to be very open as well. Because there are so many treatment options, it's okay to say, okay, these side effects are just awful and potentially switch to another option. As you said, it's not only when, you know, patients were only living 3 or 4 years, it was also when there were only 3 or 4 different treatments that you knew, well, you couldn't really switch off because then you're risking becoming resistant and you lose an option.
Sure. Well, I'm just waiting for you guys to do something like, do we have an acupuncture, a key acupuncture spot for you? Or we have good news on the medical marijuana front, or, you know... No, I get it, but that is something to think about, and that is something that, you know, really isn't being done. And like I said, the hemoncs aren't going to do it, and family practitioners, general practitioners, about all they do these days is coordinate referrals. So, you know, nobody's really, so it would be nice to almost have a, just like, let's see, is there room here at the top of your site? Well, there's room for another tab or two. like you don't have your fingers in every pie already, but it would be interesting to you know, branch out a little bit and think about ways that we can that would allow us to function better. And you're right, if there's less toxicity and if the drugs match up better, there would be less toxicity. It's just not as fun as me inviting you down to the beach party in April or something. Let's have a little fun with this thing.
Yeah, I mean, but I think, too, you know, perhaps Compass can start to shed light on, okay, these patients are expressing, you know, awful bone pain. You know, are there, mutations or signatures that, you know, can predict those patients early on before that bone pain starts and do something to prevent it? I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, very, I'm talking myself conceptually, but, you know, I do think hopefully we can learn from patients and understand why one patient may have certain symptoms versus another, and are there ways, again, to prevent that from becoming such a huge issue.
Sure. Well, I know you have a wonderful family, and you don't have a life because you've given your life basically for patients like us, and I want to thank you for that. But I think they still remember what you. I posted a picture of you on my blog today. I got a late start, but it's like a realtor. Have you ever noticed the realtors? Their pictures are all like 15 year, almost look like high school graduation photos, and that's sort of what your photo looks like. So
okay, I'll go check it out. Now I'm curious.
Yeah, you're looking good. I didn't know you're still 28, but that's good. thanks for all you do.
Thanks,
Gary.
Pat.
Yeah, thank you, Pat, and I hope you feel better.
The C. diff can't be that bad if I can kid around like this, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we don't know. We don't know where you're sitting right now.
that's too close to the truth there, Gary.
Priya, how about some of the callers?
Yeah, thank you, Gary. Listeners, if you have a question for Anne, please press 1 on your keypads and let us know. We'll bring you on air to ask your questions. Meanwhile, Anne, we have received some questions from our listeners on our website. We'll just go through them. Yes, the first one is, does the MMRF support early intervention in those with smoldering multiple myeloma? If so, can you elaborate and provide specifics if there are MMRF clinical trials in development?
Yes, so perhaps this question came in before I covered it. We do have, through our clinical research network, the MMRC, two clinical trials right now open for smoldering patients. One, which is daratumumab or Darzalex, the antibody that was approved at the end of the year, and then one that's elotuzumab or Implicity plus RevDex. And both are open at several different centers. If you log on to myelomatrials.org, you should be able to see the sites for those, or you can call our patient support center at 1-866-603-6628. And get more information about those trials.
Thank you, ma'am. The next question is, how long will it be before we can see some reduction in the cost of these new myeloma drugs?
Well, all these crystal ball questions, that certainly is a really, really important issue. And, where we really set our focus is on value, and another, I didn't outline it as one of our strategic priorities, if you will, but it is an area where we are thinking about and how might we use our data, again, to better identify specific patient populations most likely to benefit. I mean, we may find, again, in that there are certain patients who only need two treatments upfront, and a proteasome inhibitor, an IMID, and a steroid, and then they may, and we could predict them by their molecular profile. Well, that certainly would you know, cut the cost in terms of a triplet, you know, unnecessarily treating patients with a triplet. So we will be, you know, looking at the data to see how this can help in that conversation, and then certainly, you know, working with different constituents, including payers, to start to better address some of these issues, particularly as patients start to live longer. You know, it does seem that perhaps some of these costs aren't going to be, you know, sustainable in the long run.
Thank you, Anne. Gary, I see you have a couple of questions more. Maybe we could just wrap up with those if you want to ask them.
Okay,
yeah.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. Actually, I have another one, which I think is a little bit more important, and that is, and you talked about smoldering and some of the things that are associated with smoldering. And I had recently read an analysis of, I guess if you go to provide your blood, you know, and they find you have MGUS, they don't accept it. So they looked at a history of that and determined that about 1% of all the people have MGUS or smoldering myeloma who, I guess it would be MGUS. And then they looked at how they progress. But 1% of the population in the United States is 3,500,000 patients. So that's a lot of folks with MGUS, and that could potentially, you know, progress to myeloma. And then another study was in blood that they did for Zeladronix and denosumab. It's the blood thing. And it shows that of those patients, they got about 12% are found in phase one, ISS staging. About a quarter, 25%, are found in stage two. And the vast majority, or 60%, are found in stage three. So if we could just find it early, you know, we wouldn't have all these issues with kidney damage and all those things, and catch it before, it, you know, so you can watch it, you know, and during the MGUS phase. But is there anything that you guys are doing at the MMRF that looks at early diagnosis and methods of early diagnosis, or at least finding it before it ends up with end organ damage, which is why people go in and why they find it in the first place?
Yeah, so we completely agree, and certainly that's why, you know, to start some of these trials in smoldering patients with, you know, treatments that don't have significant toxicities, can you delay that, the progression of the disease? We're also, there are, you know, our investigators and our team here are considering, you know, back to your point about MGUS patients, you know, there do seem to be some, you know, some consensus around predictive factors for that 20% of MGUS patients that will progress to myeloma. And do we, you know, do we not just do a trial in smoldering? Do we do a trial in those high-risk MGUS patients? You know, the other thing that we have that, you know, we really, you know, the resource that we have to figure out how we use this knowledge through COMPASS to qualify. Patients can't have been on any treatments yet. They have to be newly diagnosed, but they need active myeloma that requires treatments. So, you know, we had a number of quote-unquote screen failures for COMPASS, and those were predominantly MGUS or smoldering patients. So, you know, there, we do have samples, some samples from patients who were quote-unquote screen failures, so they're not part of COMPASS if they didn't progress during the enrollment time. And really, you know, again, talking about how we look at that resource potentially to see if, you know, there's any insights to be gained in terms of predicting, again, who may be more likely to progress, and then, you know, targeting those patients for trials.
You know, logic would tell me that, you know, given, you know, phase, they, you know, there's an analysis that says you live three times as long if it's found in stage one than if you find it in stage three. So so that if you find it in stage zero or before it even starts, or smoldering, or stage zero, which is MGUS, you know, maybe it's even greater. You know, if you look at, what is it, Palumbo who did the study, or is it San Miguel? San Miguel, I think, who did the study of using Revlimid Dex on,
right,
on high-risk patients, and he found out that the high-risk patients using Rev Dex live twice as long as those who were watchful waiting, and then treated. So,
yep.
You know, finding it early and nipping it in the bud seems so logical.
Yeah, no, there's no question the disease becomes. I mean, I think, you know, we all just see it, how resistant the disease becomes, the longer, through the more relapses that a patient has.
Yeah, do you get it when it's a scratch, or do you treat it when it's a scratch, or do you treat it when it becomes gangrene, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, that was my question, and thank you so much, Anne, for all that you do. I'll turn it back over to Priya.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Anne. It was great listening and learning. Hopefully, 2016 would continue with last year's run and bring more positive results for our myeloma patient community. I thank the Myeloma panel. We've been always wonderful, as always. Please visit myeloma.trialx.com for myeloma clinical trials. Today's talk will be made available on CureTalks website along with its transcript. CureTalks.com will have details of upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so
much.
Take care.